Friendship, true friendship, is a beautiful thing, and the bond between women friends can be powerful.
I am able to connect with her on a level that I haven't been able to find almost anywhere else.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll talk about women friends and how women communicate with each other. While these bonds can be powerful, the way women communicate with each other can be fascinating and at times frustrating. Linguist Deborah Tannen has studied our communication patterns and breaks it all down in her new book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. I'll talk with her. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you've ever had a difficult time understanding a woman, this hour is for you. Friendship between women can be beautiful, important, sanity-saving, or even life-saving. But there are times when the way some women communicate can be baffling or frustrating. This hour, we'll talk about women friends and how women communicate with each other. Linguist Deborah Tannen will join us in a moment. But to start us off, Iowa Public Radio production assistant Chelsea Hoy asked some Iowa City women to share their feelings about their friendships with other women.
My roommate and I are best friends, and it's really nice having someone I can come home to and talk to them about anything.
I think it's important to have friends who are women. I think it's also important to have a balance of genders, but I think women in particular, it's nice to have that shared experience as women and have that support without having to always like verbalize that and explain it. Just having that like baseline understanding.
I have different friends that I confide in about different things. So somebody who I might have met through political things, I confide in with her about political opinions and thoughts and feelings that I might not share with somebody else. And then I have childhood friends who, you know, I can talk to about my past and my history. And so I have several different friends that I confide in different things about.
No, I have a sister who's kind of like a best friend, but not outside my family.
So I have a lot of really close friends that are female, but one of my best friends, her name is Angela. I've been friends with her for about 5 years now. We are able to tell each other everything, even the gross things and the weird things, and I am able to connect with her on a level that I haven't been able to find almost anywhere else.
The voices of some Iowa City women talking about their relationships with other women. And linguist Deborah Tannen has studied the communication patterns of women. She breaks it all down in her new book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. And she is with me now. Hello, Deborah.
Hi, so nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you have, over your tenure, studied a lot of communication skills, a lot of different kinds of relationships. Why female friends? Why did that interest you?
This is the third all-female relationship that plays such a large part in many of our lives. My last book was about sisters, and the one before that was mothers and daughters. And less is written about friends, although many of us spend more time with friends, especially if we live somewhere apart from our families, than we do with sisters and with parents. So it's a relationship that is so precious, but also can get complicated. What a wonderful way you started with. I love those quotes. They really capture many of the things that I write about in the book and reflect the title. We heard somebody say, we can tell each other everything, or I confide in different people about different things. So you're the only one I can tell about this, and you're the only one I can tell about that. And so many of what people said when you asked them about friends was about talk. Someone I can come to at the end of the day and tell about the day. Someone I can talk to about anything. These are the kinds of comments that I heard from the many women I interviewed, over 80, and they range in age from 9 to 97. So this is something that lasts our entire lives, but very much made of talk. And because girls and women tend to talk more, tend to talk about more personal topics, and maybe more frequently as well, we do have more opportunity to say the wrong thing. And
well, you have
hurt others' feelings.
Right. Speaking of talking, we do a lot of talking. And you draw a beautiful distinction early in the book that gives a nice way to illustrate the different focus that many women have than men have in the kinds of information that they would share with each other. You write about a couple that is friends with another couple, and the wives spend time together, the husbands spend time together, and after these social interactions, the husband and wife come back together, and the wife says, "It's just so sad that they're getting divorced." And he says, "What? They're getting divorced?" So these women, of course, had been sharing this intimate, this personal information, and the men had been playing tennis together and apparently not sharing information about the biggest things in their lives.
Yes, and that specific one was told to me by a man. He said, "The topic of our marriage never came up." But that is really quite common, and I've heard of that scenario from many people over the years. And you kind of see it reflected in this conversation that was reported to me. A woman told me about calling her son. He had recently graduated from college, was now living in a distant city. And she asked about a particular friend that she also knew quite well. And she asked him, how's Mike doing? Have you talked to him lately? And he said, yeah, talked to him yesterday. Well, how's he doing? I don't know. Well, how's his job? I don't know. How's his girlfriend? Don't know. Well, didn't you just talk to him? Yeah, talked to him yesterday. Well, what did you talk about? Football? Did you only talk about football? No. Soccer, too. Well, and that does kind of capture that difference.
in a nutshell, the fact that women talk about these more intimate things, tend to talk about these more intimate things with each other, that's part of the connection as well, right? The part of the affiliation is revealing something about yourself and allowing the woman or the girl that you're talking to also reveal something.
Yes, absolutely. So one woman said, much like the quotes that you had at the beginning from the Iowa women, someone I'm close to, I tell her everything I think and everything I feel. And I was very touched by this one way one person put it. She said, when I tell someone something personal, it's like saying, here's a little piece of me. That means I like you. And I thought that was such a beautiful way to put it. But when you think about it, they now have a piece of you. And you have to, you have to worry about what are they going to do with it.
Right, you have to trust them with that piece.
So there has to be that level of trust. And sometimes they might repeat something because they didn't realize it was supposed to be secret. Let it go, let it out inadvertently. But sometimes if they get mad at you, they can repeat it on purpose. And This is a very interesting thing. Girls and women can be pretty competitive about who knows what and who knows first. So if you have a group of friends, the one who knows something important first, they get a kind of prestige from that. And so how can it's almost like a competition about who's the closer friend. And one way you can show that you're close is to show that you know something that the others don't know. So that can be a temptation as well.
Well, it's interesting. You point out that this sharing of secrets, this revealing of personal information is a pattern that starts really early with girls as opposed to with boys. It's something that you can observe in kindergarten.
Absolutely. This goes way back. In 1990, I published a book called You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. And I had a lot of discussion there of research that had been done on children at play. And they found that girls tend to prefer to play with girls, boys tend to prefer to play with boys. They play very differently. And there's this typical almost iconic image of two little girls, and one is whispering in the other's ear. And I now collect pictures from all over the world of little girls where one is whispering in the other's ear. It's not that you'll never see boys doing that, but it's just far less common. And the I used to say when that book came out, it was almost like a mantra. My mother used to make fun of me and recite it back to me. For girls and women, your best friend is the one you tell everything to. For boys and men, your best friend is the one you do everything with. And that is a pattern that people who studied kids at play found, that for girls and women, often for little girls, their best friend was the one that they were sharing secrets with. So and that is maybe secrets. We don't think of it exactly as secrets when we're adults, but it's really a pattern that we repeat throughout our lives, that people we're close to, especially women we're close to, we will tell things to. But I'll tell you something funny. A woman I was interviewing made a comment. She was telling about various friends, and she said about one friend, "Oh, you know, we're not that close. I wouldn't tell her about my kids' problems." And then at another point in the interview, she said about someone else, "You know, we're not that close friends. I wouldn't tell her what I had for dinner." Now, at first, that might seem odd. Why is what you had for dinner so special? But when you think about it, it's exactly what that first woman you quoted at the beginning from Iowa City, she said, "Someone I can come home to and tell about anything, tell what happened during the day." When you're really close to somebody, it's very precious that you can tell them the little things that happened during the day. And this is one thing, by the way, that I wrote about in You Just Don't Understand, that sometimes creates confusion between women and men, where she might say, "I did this, I did that, here's who I met, that's what they said, that's what I thought, that's what I felt, and how was your day?" And he might say, "Fine, didn't anything happen? Nope. Same old rat race." But then later they might be out with a group of people, and suddenly he'll be regaling the audience with something funny that happened during the day. And she might feel, "What am I, chop liver? You just should tell me first, right? Your best friend is the one you tell everything to." So it's a really different sense of what's anything to tell. And it's very common for women to feel, if you're close to somebody, I want to tell them all the little details of my life, and they will tell me the little details of their life. And it makes you feel less alone as you go through the day, knowing that there's going to be someone who's going to be interested to hear about it. Of course, now you don't have to wait till the end of the day. You can just take a picture and send it.
Right. We will talk more about how technology has changed how we communicate a little bit later on in the hour. One of the things I really enjoyed about the book, and we're coming up on a break here, but maybe you can give me a definition here. But for so many of the things I've been engaging in my whole life, you've given me new language to think about them with. And one of those things is troubles talk. That's a phrase that you use a lot. And can you give us just a brief definition?
Yes. It's the idea that a good topic for conversation is troubles. And if you have troubles, you really value being able to talk about it with someone. And this, again, tends to be different for women. Many men feel, "I don't want to talk about it." That just makes it worse. Why talk about it if you don't want to do anything about it?
Well, we will.
We can talk more after the break.
Oh, we will. We'll get into the troubles talk in just a moment. My guest today is linguist Deborah Tannen. Her latest book is You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. We also want to hear from you this hour. Your stories, your confusion, your questions, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about friendships between women and how women communicate with each other. Linguist Deborah Tannen is here. She's the author most recently of You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Deborah, just before the break, we started talking about troubles talk and the fact that when women come together, they often talk about the problems that they have in their lives. That's part of how they connect. That's also part of maybe how they troubleshoot what's going on, or maybe not. In that exchange. This is one of the places that, that women often have miscommunication with men or feel frustrated with men because they'll share their troubles and then the man that they're talking to will offer some solutions. And that's not typically what women are looking for when they want to share their trouble.
Yes. Now, that's something I wrote about in You Just Don't Understand. That was one of the things that was really picked up in the book and really became part of the culture, I think. And that was a typical conversation where a woman might talk about a problem to a man she's close to, and he might then tell her how to fix the problem. Then they're both frustrated. And what I wrote in the book at the time and what is often said now, and there's some truth to it, is she didn't want a solution. She wanted to talk about it. And he's frustrated because his feeling is, why do you want to talk about it if you don't want to do anything about it? I actually would say something a little bit different. Now, I don't think that's completely accurate. It isn't so much that she didn't want a solution, but she didn't want it right off the bat. So how would a conversation go with a woman friend? And since we're saying this, I'll say right now, nothing is true of all women or all men. We're talking about tendencies. So this is a common way that it might go with a friend. So you tell about a problem and the friend might, you know, something, conversation with somebody that was difficult. And the person, the friend might say, oh, well, why do you think he said that? And then what did he say? And what did you say? And how did he react to that? And what do you think you might do? And how do you think he'd react if you did that? And they might end up giving advice, but they need to get this kind of information before they know what advice to give. There's something else going on, too. I talk about message and meta-message. So the message is the meaning of the words, but the meta-message is what it says about the relationship that you say these words in this way, in this context. Simply having this kind of conversation where somebody asks you these questions, they're taking the time to explore this with you, that in itself sends a meta message of caring and closeness. So I think of a woman who said, and I think she was just typical, a close friend is someone I can call when something's bothering me and she'll help me process it. That's the kind of conversation that I just described. Well, I think often, because that's not a kind of conversation that is as common among men, they don't recognize that this is the ritual that's being started. And so they really think that if you tell me about the problem, you're asking for a solution. What's so hurtful in close relationships, and I have a lot of examples of other kinds of differences that come up between friends, you think your intentions are good, you know your intentions are good, and you're accused of bad intentions. And that can be just so disappointing. So I think the frustration from that conversation I described where she's telling about the problem and he gives her the solution, the biggest issue there is that the solution shuts down the conversation. But having that kind of conversation was the point. That's why she started it, because of that feeling of connection and caring that you get when you can go through that kind of ins and outs with someone about an issue that's bothering you.
Well, and you talk about how a good friend usually will ask these follow-up questions. That's part of the process. But another part of a friendship, of course, is that it's a two-way street. And that's another area where conflict can come into play when you share something with someone else but fail to ask them about themselves.
Yes. So there are a number of ways that that can misfire. So one is an assumption that you're going to tell your friends what's going on in your life, and she's going to tell you what's going on in her life. Many women referred to that. A friend is someone who knows what's going on with me. And one woman told me about a good friend who had been having an affair and hadn't told her. And we can understand why somebody might make that choice, but this woman was very hurt. She said, during that time, I had been telling her about my problems. During that time, I was helping her out with other things. We traveled together. And when I learned that she was having this affair and had not told me about it, she said, I felt she had lied to me. And that's very interesting to me, because why was it a lie? She didn't say something that wasn't true. But the assumption is, you're telling me what's going on in your life. And if she wasn't, it was like she was pretending everything was fine, when it wasn't. So that's one way people can get frustrated. There's another thing, and this gets into an issue that I write quite a bit about, conversational style differences. So a woman told me she had shared with a friend that her mother was in the hospital, and she was, of course, very concerned about this. And she expected her friend to follow up by asking, "How's your mother?" And she was hurt that the friend didn't. Again, meta message. She saw it as a meta message that she doesn't care. Well, she, in this case, told the friend how she felt, and the friend said, "Oh my goodness, in my family, we were taught you never ask questions like that. If somebody wants to tell you something personal like that, they'll volunteer." So it was a conversational style difference, and that is always a challenge that we have. Are you going to mention something potentially hurtful? How are you feeling about having lost, that breakup, or how are you feeling about having failed that test? If you say something about it, you show that you care, but you're bringing up a painful topic. And we often are confused about what's the best way to handle it.
Well, and you write about several different communication styles. One of the things that starts to point to is the sort of indirect communication that a lot of women engage in, where whoever they're talking to, they expect to be able to glean the meaning from what they're saying and how they're saying it, not necessarily the words they're saying, but the whole package. And you have a wonderful example of this between a conversation between two professional women, where one woman was supposed to present at a conference and she got sick. Can you flesh that out a little
yes.
bit for us?
Yes, yes, yes. I have quite a bit about indirectness because it comes up so often and is so fascinating. I was going to take part in a conference where I was one of the plenary speakers. And when I appeared, the organizer of the conference said, referring to another plenary speaker who was a friend of both of ours, she said, "Judy isn't coming because she called me this morning and she said, I have a fever, I'm feeling horrible, but if you really need me, I'll come." And she reported to me, the organizer said, "And I told her, I really need you to stay home and take care of yourself." And this was such a wonderful example of indirectness that I said to her, "That's great. Can I refer to that in my talk today?" And she said, "Yes, that was such great direct communication."
Well, they understood each other perfectly.
Why did she? Exactly. When Judy said, "If you really need me, I'll be there," she knew that her friend was not going to say, "I don't care if you're falling over, sick, come, I need you." But by being indirect, she allowed the organizer to let her off the hook. And you can see how you both might feel better about that. Judy didn't feel like she had let her friend down because the friend let her off the hook. The organizer didn't feel she was presented with a fait accompli. She felt that she had some agency in it, and she could end up feeling, "I was such a good friend." And then I contrast it with a conversation that I overheard, which shows the liability of indirectness. So I was in the office of another academic woman, a colleague. This was before things were coming through email. This was when people had to make phone calls. So I heard her phone rang, and she picked it up, and I heard her side of it. And it was something like this. "Oh, gee, I don't see how I could possibly take on anything more. I'm teaching an overload course this term. I'm on the rank and tenure committee. I knew it would be a lot of work, but it's way more work than I realized. I don't see how I could possibly do it. But if you can't find anybody else, of course, I wouldn't leave you high and dry." And then she hung up the phone and she looked at me with an expression of utter shock. And she said, "I can't believe it. I told him I couldn't do it, and he put me on the committee anyway." And of course, and I said, "Well, actually, you didn't explicitly tell him you couldn't do it.
In fact, you explicitly said you would."
Yeah. And if it had been, and obviously this isn't every man or every woman that communicates this way, but it probably would have been more likely that a woman would have understood that she was supposed to say, "Of course, I'll find someone else." But literally, she said, "I'll do it if you need me." And he felt he needed her, so he felt that she said she would do it. But I have many examples in the book of misunderstandings like that between women.
Oh, absolutely.
So this was, I think this was one.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, this is such an interesting part of our culture because, of course, we're all socialized differently. From my personal experience, I've had many misunderstandings because I tend to be more factual and more frank than a lot of women are. And it has led to problems for me, although from my perspective, that seems like a better solution to say, what you mean.
I am so often asked, wouldn't it be a better world if we all just said what we meant? And I always say we do, but we say what we mean in our own conversational styles. And there are so many other influences other than gender. Part of the country you come from, ethnicity, class, sexual orientation, the kind of work that you do. And I've written about all these differences. I'll tell you an example of a northern difference. So some of you may have already guessed this from my way of speaking. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I was talking to a friend who was from the South. So I asked her about a particular person we both knew, though neither of us knew him very well, and I asked her what she thought of him. And she said, I don't really know him. And I said, I think he's a jerk. And she said, that's what I just said. And then she explained, in South Carolina, she said, you cannot say someone is a jerk. You have to proceed on the assumption that if you knew him long enough, you would find something to like about him. So when you say, I don't really know him, you're saying, I haven't found anything to like about him. Well, I was fascinated by this, but a little bit dubious. Not too much long after, I was at some kind of event, and I met someone who said he was from South Carolina, so this was a good chance to test it. I asked him, if you asked someone what they thought of someone, and they said, I don't really know him, what would that mean? And he said, that means he's a no good, no count. So, completely understandable to people who share that style, completely opaque to people who don't. And think for a second what she must have thought of me saying, I think he's a jerk. You can't say that. So she must have drawn well, we were pretty good friends. I hope that she didn't, but I could imagine someone drawing conclusions about the kind of person this person is, saying things like that.
Well, and if that's a conflict between New York and South Carolina, and certainly as a Midwesterner, people often have liked to stereotype us and talk about our unusual ways of communication. But it's even bigger if it's somebody from another country or maybe a completely different kind of socioeconomic background.
Absolutely. All those differences. I quote a woman who wrote a book about the French, different ideas of friendship between French and American women. So she was French living in the United States. And a friend of hers called up, a French friend called up and said how tired she was because her kids were exhausting her. And she said, well, why don't you bring them over and I'll watch them for a while and you can get a break. The friend did bring the kids over, but she came in and she sat down and she started going on, you are a real friend. You know what friendship is. American women don't know what friendship is. I was saying the same thing to this friend of mine, American friend, and do you think she ever made offer to watch my kids or do anything? No. What a hypocrite. And this word hypocrite, when it's said across cultures, is always revealing because a hypocrite is somebody who doesn't talk in the way they should given the situation. But we have these differences of what we think is the appropriate way to speak in a situation. Well, this French anthropologist went on to explain a contrasting conversation she had with an American friend. So the American friend was talking about, again, a mutual friend they had who was French, and she said, can you imagine I was talking about how busy I was and she actually offered to watch my kids? Well, how insulting. She doesn't even think I'm capable of taking care of my work and my kids. So exactly the thing that the French woman thought was the way a friend should behave, the American woman thought was insulting. And there are so many other examples of that, and I discuss quite a few in the book.
Absolutely. I want to get to the phones here, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Kristen is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, absolutely. And I know you want to talk about some ways that women can get into conflicts with one another. What's your story?
So my question is, I've had several relationships that have been, you know, some of the deepest and best of my life, but it seems like it always at some point becomes a problem professionally, and we start to compete with each other, just in life or just, you know, in terms of job. And it's subtle, you know, and I always feel it, and then I try to fix it, but it's so hard to fix it directly and talk to the person if something like that is going on. And you know you're competing with each other, but, you know, how do you resolve? So I guess that's my question, is how do you resolve those types of conflicts before it's too late?
Absolutely. Kristen, thank you so much for your call. And you write a lot about connection versus competition, and there can be positive and negative aspects to both, but competition can be a really difficult thing in women's relationships.
Yes, I have a chapter on that. Often it's not completely clear what is connection and what is competition, but part of the reason this gets so complicated among women's friendships is that there's kind of a negative association with competition. It's expected from any man. It's expected that you're going to have competition, and they might joke about it. They might play it up. They might insult each other. You know, or I can do this so much better than you. I'm gonna leave you in the dust here. And they make a joke of it that way. For many girls and women, we don't want to talk about having competition because we feel that it's unacceptable. But sometimes we can feel there's competition when it's not clear that there is. So just a few small examples.
Well, let's get into the examples in just a moment. We're going to have to take another short break. And Kristen, we will continue talking about this when we get back. My guest is Deborah Tannen. She's the author most recently of You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. Again, you're welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100 or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about relationships between women and how women communicate with each other. My guest is Deborah Tannen. Her most recent book is You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. And she studied dozens of exchanges between women to talk about different ways that we communicate with each other, some of the patterns that a lot of women engage in their communication. And just before the break, we started talking about competition, which is something that enters into a lot of relationships between women, something that can ruin relationships between women, something that sometimes can help everybody be a little stronger or get a little better. But, I mean, Deborah, you were just talking about how a lot of women have this very negative idea of competition.
Yes, and sometimes it's not clear what is competition and what's connection. So, small example, we talked about troubles talk. You talk about a problem and your friend says, oh, I know I had the same problem. Well, what if it sounds like the problem she starts to tell you about is worse? You can feel like she's saying, oh, your problem's nothing. Let's not even talk about your problem. Let's talk about my problem. and it's not always clear whether she really is intending to shift the focus to herself, whether she really is trying to top you or trying to match it. I have my students bring in examples frequently of their own conversations, and then they analyze it in terms of the kinds of things we've been discussing in class related to this. And one woman talked about how it's finals time. She was commiserating with a friend about, my finals and my papers are so late. Everyone else's will have gone home and I'll still be here studying. And her friend said, oh, my situation is much worse. I don't even have time to study because they're all coming up so close. And they started going back and forth almost like a competition. No, mine is much worse. No, mine is much worse. Oh, I wish I had yours. Yours is easier. So that can sometimes be unclear. You can feel that somebody is topping you. It's not completely clear whether that is the intention. Is Kristen still on the line?
No, she's no longer with us.
Yeah, because she mentioned the feeling that there's competition at work and asking how to deal with that. And one thing I would say is that how to deal with it can be different depending on the other person and that person's style. So there are some people who are very open to talking about it. And everybody will feel better if you can talk about it. I'm happy for you, but I have to admit I'm a little bit jealous. You're getting all this attention, and I'm happy you're getting it, but I'm human. I feel a little bad that I'm not getting it. Other people would be horrified if you tried to put that into words and actually talk about it, and they might feel, what a horrible thing to say. I would never feel that. So you always have to know the style of the person you're dealing with in order to know what's the best way to handle it.
And the interesting thing there is also we tend to be, many of us, attracted to people with similarities to us. So friends that are in similar parts of life to us, friends that may be in the same career as us or in the same line of work. And that seems like that can heighten that competition factor as well.
I do have a chapter about sameness and difference. This is something that comes up in just about all the conversations I've had with people about friendship and also about sisters, also about mothers and daughters. Sometimes they're saying, we're close because we're so similar. And sometimes they say, it's because we're so different that we value our friendship. One woman said that she and her best friend refer to themselves as yin and yang because they're so different. Well, in the system of yin and yang, those they're different, but they complement each other. And so I think there, too, there's going to be different senses of whether it's good or bad to be different or same or different in different ways. And what I think you really have to watch out for is a feeling that something's wrong because the other one is not replying or acting the way you would. And you really have to think about whether it means the same thing to her that it does to you.
Well, you also write about a woman who she had young children and started spending time with other mothers. And she thought that this would be a very supportive environment and, a place to talk about what was going on in her life, maybe vent and get some ideas. And she found that it became very competitive very quickly. I mean, we also have to be aware of when something is healthy for us and when something is
yes.
not healthy for us, because obviously other people can have very different experiences in coming together with people at a similar point in their lives.
Yeah, I would love to contrast these two anecdotes that people told me about. One is the positive side of commiserating. So a woman recalled she was at home with her small children. Her neighbor was at home with small children the same age, child the same age. She said the neighbor called up and said, her son had dropped a jar of mayonnaise, spread it all over the floor, added eggs to it because he was going to make a cake. Her neighbor called and she said she just left the mess and came over and we drank coffee and commiserated. That word commiserated is so great. So that's troubles talk. And the feeling was we were in the same boat. Just knowing that there's somebody else going through the same thing I'm going through was a comfort. A woman that I interviewed, an academic woman, told about struggling with, as so many women do when they work, having her children and her work competing demands. When she was at work, she felt she should be with her children. When she was with her children, she felt she should be at work. There was a meeting called of academic women in her university, and she was so looking forward to talking to people who could commiserate. They were going through the same thing. Well, she said, they started talking about heroic stories. Oh, I gave birth, and 3 days later, I was back in the classroom. And she said, I wasn't going to tell my stories after that. So that ended up feeling to her as rather competitive.
Absolutely. And we want to get back to the phones. George is on the line in Mason City. Hi, George.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking the call. I hope this isn't going to be too involved. I wanted to talk about something that I discovered after 20 years of marriage about the guest versus family relationship between my family here in the Midwest and my husband's family in New England. I was inspired to call by the conversation about the North Carolina, was it, or South Carolina?
Sure, the South cultural Carolina. Differences, right?
Yes. So I met my husband when I was in college out east, and well, I guess I should. And I tried to be the optimal guest as I understood it from being out here, which was when it was time to clear the dishes from the table, I volunteered to help, or I, you know, may I fix a meal? You know, I can run to the grocery store. Can I pick up things? You know, like, and my future in-laws just kind of seemed taken a little bit aback, but, you know, then let me help. But I was felt like they were backing away from me a little bit. And so I tried to tone it down, but you know, a good guest offers to help. And then I've been married to my husband for a number of years, but at about the 20-year mark, we were discussing Thanksgiving at my sister's. And my family tends to get together around projects, including big family meals like Thanksgiving, and everybody sits down with the carrot peelers, or, you know, and it's a good time to talk, or, you know, or canning or whatever, you know.
So your family expects the help.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And everybody participates, you know, in the preparation or the cleanup, or, you know, everybody participates, whether it's building a wall or doing, you know, whatever. But my husband would frequently take a nap, or but he was given, I almost hate to mention it on the phone, but he has a job where he's sometimes on call overnight. So they would say, well, he was, you know, working hard or whatever. But then another woman married into the family, and she was kind of doing what my husband was doing, and not watching her child from a previous marriage who was more disruptive and, you know, sort of being more of a, I don't have to say burden on the family, but, you know, just not following the mold, the expected.
Well, and George, I want to give Deborah an opportunity to respond to that. Definitely a cultural difference there. You actually write about that very difference in the book.
Absolutely. I have an example of something very, very similar. A friend who came over for dinner and kept offering to help, and I kept telling her I didn't want her to, and I really didn't want her to, and she just kept getting up again. At one point, she almost made it into the kitchen. I grabbed her by the arm, pulled her back, plopped her down. I tried to make it into a good-hearted thing, but it was really getting to me. And because I was writing the book, I wanted to get her perspective. So I actually asked her about it when we were together after that. And she got this look of astonishment on her face. And she said, oh, my goodness, I can see that other people have reacted to me that way. And I never knew why. And she realized, she said, she had just been at her mother's. And it went something like this. She offered to help. Her mother said no. She got up anyway. She cleared the table. Her mother said don't. She did it anyway. She washed the dishes. Her mother said stop it. She did it anyway. And when it was over, her mother said, thank you. And at one point, her mother said, you never listen to me, and I'm so glad you don't. And she said, in my family, I don't want you to help means you shouldn't help because you're a guest, so I appreciate it all the more when you do. It had never occurred to her that when I said I didn't want her to help, I meant it. And it had never occurred to me that she might think I didn't mean it. I could not understand why she kept trying when I had said I didn't want her to.
Interesting.
So, yeah, the expectations of what a guest should do, we take them so for granted. It's self-evident that this is the way you should behave. Something similar, again, ways of talking. Do you show interest by asking a lot of questions, or is that intrusive? And so you can get complaints. Your family isn't interested in me. They never ask me anything. Your family is so intrusive. They keep asking me all these questions.
So many differences. I want to, before we run out of time, you know, I think a lot of us have this idea that we need to have women friends, that that's an incredibly important part of our lives. But then a lot of us have had really negative experiences with women friends, with groups of women. And I want to just hit on a couple of the things that you discovered in looking at different ways that women communicate that can be so damaging. For some women, I mean, one of them is cutoffs, just stopping communication with someone without ever telling them why. And that was a pattern that you found again and again.
Yes, very striking. And in a way puzzling because, as you said, women's friendships tend to be more intimate, more involving, can be. Many men are puzzled, you know, that their women friend, their women in their lives talk about their friends at such length and can get so hurt by things that go wrong. I heard things like women's friendships are as sustaining as air, the most sustaining thing in my life. And yet, much more common among women friends than men to have these cutoffs where you completely stop talking to someone and don't tell them why. And this was very striking because most of the women I talked to had experienced this on both sides. When someone cut them off, they did not know why, and that was part of the what made it so painful. When they cut somebody else off, they always knew why, but they often didn't tell them. So that was a puzzle. I think part of the reason, and I asked people the reasons they cut people off, and there was a whole range. One woman told me that there was a time in her life when she just was dealing with a lot and cut everybody off. Another woman said she would tend to get so close to people that it would be overwhelming, and she would cut it off. And sometimes, if you're especially a young person living with parents or guardians, they make you cut the friendship off. And the friend doesn't know that. They're wondering what they did. But the truth is, both friends are getting their hearts broken.
That they didn't tell, this pattern showed up again and again, but one of the reasons they didn't tell the person why they were cutting them off was because that felt like a problem-solving technique.
Exactly.
They would just extend the relationship.
It's very, very intriguing. If you say to somebody, you're doing this, you're doing that, that's why I'm ending it, it's like you're inviting them to say, I won't do it anymore. But you've already made your decision that you want it to be over and you don't want to start that conversation. I can think of a friend who said, I called up, this goes way, way back, about a boyfriend. I called him up and I told him I never want to see him again. And I'm thinking, why call him up if you don't want to see him again? Don't continue the conversation. But some of it, I think, is we all really dislike conflict. Most of us are very uncomfortable with conflict, and it can be true for many men as well as many women. And so if you express something negative, the person might get upset, they might blame you, you really don't want that conflict. And sometimes I think if you had confronted the friend earlier, they would have been able to stop that behavior that was bothering you earlier, and maybe you wouldn't have had to cut them off. But that resistance of conflict, I think, can contribute to that.
One of the things I was struck by, again, we have these idealized images of relationships, of women friends. And you wrote at length about the fact that our need for friendship, our relationships with different friends, it changes over time. So you may be crazy about somebody. They're your best friend forever at a certain point in your life. But at another point in your life, you're not going to have anything in common with that person. Is that something that we should all take to heart and remember that things change over time and we shouldn't blame ourselves or our friends for that change?
Yes, I would say that probably a takeaway from every one of my books, and this one included, is to maybe blame ourselves less, because some of the things we're going through are things other people are going through too. But different stages of your life, different friends may be more important, less important. And sometimes it's just a matter of how much time you have. Women have small children at home, often it's the mothers of other kids the same age that become their close friends. And maybe they grow away from some friends from earlier in their lives. And when the kids are grown and out of the house, they reunite with those friends. So moving away now doesn't mean you can't find each other again later.
Another one of the idealized ideas that we have is that we'll find that friend who just understands us without us ever having to speak. Do you find that can be a damaging idea?
I guess it's always risky to want to be understood without putting it into words. On the other hand, it does happen, and it's so comforting when
and
it
magical
does.
When it does. Well, Deborah Tammann, yeah. We could talk for a couple more hours, but thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you. You've been great to talk to.
Deborah Tannen, her most recent book is You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.